This is The Source on KSTX, a product of the Texas Public Radio Newsroom. I'm David Martin Davies. While the San Antonio area has been blessed with some rainfall, don't be lulled into thinking that the drought is busted. South Texas and Texas as a whole is still in the vice-like grip of the drought, and farmers and ranchers are dealing with the reality of a growing scarcity of water. And that grim reality is creeping closer to us city dwellers. More municipalities are dealing with water shortages, and food prices are being driven up by harsher and extreme weather conditions. We are going to spend some time with the next hour talking about the drought, climate change, and what this means for food production. We start off by talking to an actual food producer, a farmer, Frank DeStefano. He grows cotton and corn in Mumford, Texas, just northwest of College Station. Welcome to The Source, Farmer.
Thank you.
And also, we're going to be talking to an author and agricultural ecologist. That's Gary Naban. He's talking about growing food in hotter climates. And we also invite your phone calls. The number is 614-8980. So, Farmer Frank DeStefano, tell me about where are you right now? Where's your? I understand you are actually at your farm.
I'm in the middle of a grain field. We're harvesting grain sorghum right now.
And how's the crop look? How's the harvest?
It's an average crop this year. We've had some isolated rains, and it's an average crop.
Now, I understand that you are a plaintiff in a I don't know if it's a complaint about what's happening with the Brazos River, because you depend upon the Brazos for irrigation.
Yes, sir. Farm Bureau has filed a suit with myself and other farmers and ranchers as plaintiffs, trying to protect our water source.
So the Brazos, a very important river for agriculture, particularly in your area, runs through Central Texas, cuts through Waco. We see developments out there wanting more water. We also see industry wanting more water, but we have farmers and people in agriculture who also depend upon that water. There's only so much water to go around.
True, and what we're concerned about is the first one they can pick on is to take it away is agriculture, and we don't think that's a fair way to do things.
So how much water would you normally use, would you get from the Brazos?
We measure our water in acre feet. We have about 450 acre feet of water. What an acre foot is if you've got an acre of land and 12 inches of water over that whole acre is an acre foot. And I use this water on a 500 acre farm, and it's enough water to grow the crops throughout the year.
And there is a Dow Chemical Company facility that has a long-standing priority right to that water, and the TCEQ is ordering customers like you to halt your water usage so that the Dow Chemical Company can have the water.
Correct, because they have a 1942 permit. We have two permits. One is a 1956, and then one is 1981 or two, I think, and so their priority call made us shut down, and certain municipalities and entities were exempted from it.
Right, usually municipalities are exempt from these orders, so that the cities can have their water. And I know that this has caused a rift, or at least some friction, between farmers such as yourself and ranchers who are growing food, and you look at cities that are probably being as careful with water as you would like.
Correct, and we do a great job of conserving water. We've gotten over the years, we've gotten better with our water usage and how we conserve, and we feel like we're doing our part, and the cities need to do their part on conserving water too.
Well, some people are saying that farmers could do better job with water conservation. or at least, and that maybe the Texas Water Development Board could do a better job of giving farmers the resources to do a better job with that, providing funding for plastic lining and drainage and irrigation ditches and things like that, so we don't lose so much water to seepage and also to evaporation.
Correct. It's true, but we've come a long way in the last 20, 30 years. Our usage is we're using less water than we did before, and we've had better ways to use it. And what we need to get a point across is agriculture. We need the when we have four families living on our farm that need we depend on this water, right? And when we get pulled mid season, it throws things in. It makes it real hard to plan on what to do, and it's a real financial strain, and it endangers people of going out of business.
You know, you hear this a lot from people saying, oh, they got crop insurance, and we've seen crop insurance payouts increase across the country due to extreme weather conditions, but people seem to think that that's a solution. What's your reaction to that?
Well, the crop insurance is, if we have our water pulled, crop insurance will not pay us on irrigated yields, and the difference in irrigated yields and dry land yields are drastic. They're over half. The irrigated yield is at least twice as much as the dry land yield, and we do not depend on crop insurance because crop insurance will not pay if you don't irrigate it.
Now, have you noticed over your years as a farmer changes in the way that the weather patterns are?
Yeah, it seems to be we're in a drier the last 5 years or so. Seems to be a drier pattern. I hope things change back, but yes, they do seem to be in a drier pattern.
Is it changing when you plant or what you plant?
It's changing, not when we plant. What we do now is we do more crop rotations better, and that crop rotation also conserves water because if you're not planting the same crop every year on the same land, you can reduce your water usage some. But so we're doing rotations every year, which helps the soil also.
Do you till or no-till?
We do minimum tillage. Years ago, we used to probably go across the field with a tractor 10 to 15 times. Now we're probably going across the fields probably 5 times now.
Right. So you feel that you guys are doing your part, trying to maximize the water usage, and you think that they're – but we still got to have this big conversation. Texas has got to come to a better understanding. Frank DeStefano, thank you so much. A farmer in Mumford, Texas, talking to us about life out there, trying to grow our crops in this time of drought. This is The Source on KSTX. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. We continue our discussion about food production in the times of climate change and drought, how hotter temperatures and shrinking supply of water is impacting farmers and ranchers and what you buy at the store. We're going to be talking to Dr. Travis Miller. He's a professor, associate head of the Agricultural Life Extension Service and program leader for the Department of Soil and Crop Sciences. I do want to share with this right now. I got this just a couple of minutes ago. This is the Texas Water Development Board's Texas Drought Report just came out a couple of minutes ago. Say the good news is that recent rains have reduced the intensity of drought for the most severe category of drought. Exceptional and has decreased in Texas from 12% to 6% in the state. The bad news is that rains were not enough to help the reservoirs across the state, and statewide reservoir storage continues on a downward slide 100,000 acre feet lower this week than last week. Drought statistics, 99% of the state is currently in drought. That's the same where it was a year ago. That's the same where it was 3 years ago, 3 months ago. But 1 year ago, we were 88% of the state was in drought. So things are indeed getting worse. Now, joining us to talk about that, Dr. Travis Miller from the AgriLife Extension Service. Thank you, Dr. Miller, for joining us.
Good afternoon.
So what's your take on the state of Texas and climate change and the drought?
That's three big topics. We have certainly have a serious drought on our hands, have had a serious drought for the last 3 years. 2010 was a pretty good year, but 11, 12, and 13 have been very dry, 11 being particularly that is our historically driest and hottest year. So serious conditions. We've seen major impacts on ag production. We've seen major impacts on water supplies. Well over 1,000 of the 4,600 or so water supply districts in the state are under one stage or another of drought, their drought contingency plan. So it's a dry time. We've got to make adequate plans to deal with it, or we'll reap the consequences.
I'm going to bring in Bob. Bob's a part-time rancher, and he called in early. He wants to join the conversation. Bob, welcome to The Source.
Hello. I think I'm Byron. You got me online?
Yes, sir. Byron, go ahead.
Yeah. I've grown up around Central Texas enough to know that we get droughts. It happens. But I think everyone knows with the competition for water as what it is today, this is something else. And I'm thinking that the way we're going, that corn and cotton and a lot of these staple products from Texas are going to be non-viable crops pretty soon unless we find a crop that uses less water. And one of those, I think everyone here, Frank, and people I've been listening to should go to votehemp.com, and we should look seriously at getting industrial hemp growing to replace ethanol and textiles and a lot of the things that we need to use corn for, because it uses less water, period. So I'd like to know what Frank's comment is on that and what your other guests have to say, and as that is an alternative for what we use.
And so when you say hemp, hemp is not used for food, right?
Hemp is used for food, but I'm trying to advocate it more for an industrial use. It can be used to replace cotton for fabrics and textiles, fuel, medicine, paper, the list goes on. But the important point is that industrial hemp uses less water than corn, and I think that's where we really need to head.
Okay. All right. Well, Byron, thank you for that call. Travis Miller, AgriLife Extension, tell me what you think about Byron's suggestion.
Well, I think our feed grains, corn and sorghum, are very important parts of the diet of poultry, livestock, dairy, you name it. I don't see where industrial hemp has a place in that. As far as a potential source for cellulosic ethanol, it may have a place there. It has a fiber source, but it's a lot coarser and less desirable than cotton for most of our fabrics. So, yeah, it may have a place as far as replacing what we currently have. I think it'd be a stretch.
Yeah, it's a no silver bullet. Hey, let's grow hemp, and then suddenly a problem solved. Well, the problem is much bigger than that. What communications are you having with our farmers and their community about how to take better care of the water, or how to deal with the issues that they're facing with water shortages?
Well, drought's been part of farming and ranching since we've had farming and ranching. I mean, you look back in history, we've had major droughts in about every 20 years or so. We'll have a major drought, and farmers have learned to minimize risk. Now, we're doing a lot of research and a lot of educational programming to reduce that risk through things as simple as cultural practices. I believe you discussed reducing tillage systems, reducing tillage, keeping more stubble on the surface is one way. We're looking at crops that are much more drought resistant than they once were. In other words, water use efficiency has gone way up with some of the newer genetics we have. So there's things we're doing as far as adapting the crops, and certainly we're seeing farmers shift to more drought-tolerant crops in areas where they have persistent drought.
But by switching to a no-till way of farming, or at least minimal till, you do increase the ability of the soil to hang on to the water. You have a lot less runoff, and you take better care of the microbial life that you know that your plants are dependent on.
You have more water infiltration, more water harvested, and you have less evaporation because every time you till, you expose moist soil to dry air and you lose water. So, yeah, it's a more water efficient. But the other things that we're doing, including more drought-tolerant genetics in crops, is also making a significant difference. In my career, I've seen a huge change in yields, and a lot of it is associated with the genetics that allow it to tolerate heat and drought stress, cotton, sorghum, and corn.
Well, Byron brought up, hemp, but there are other crops out there that are our Texas farmers don't grow, but maybe they should take a look at maybe some products that grow well in more drought-stressed parts of the world, things like millet or amaranth. These are grains that are superfoods, they're said to be, and they grow well in drought conditions.
One of the crops we're seeing an increase of is sesame. Sesame is a crop that's very well adapted to hot, dry conditions. The millet thing is a function of markets. Amaranth is as well. I think both of them might have a spot, but it's most farmers don't have access to the markets for those things. So it's an infrastructure deal, building up a market channel so farmers can sell it.
So how water smart are our farmers and ranchers? Are they really doing all that they can right now, still being able to be economically viable, but to conserve water?
I think we've seen a huge change in irrigated agriculture in the last 25 to 30 years. Most of the irrigation that's done in Texas now is done with center pivot irrigation or subsurface drip. And those systems can be as high as the center pivots can be as high as 95% efficient, and the subsurface drip is darn close to 100. Just depends on whether you have a leak or two. So yeah, we've seen major increases in water use efficiency on irrigation, and some of the other things I've talked about on dry land: reducing tillage, deep fertilizer banding. Water-efficient crops has made a huge difference. Not that that means a whole lot to the watershed, but it means a whole lot in water, using better the water that falls on your land.
We got an email from Anthony. It says, my partner and I operate a farm ranch utilizing irrigation. We recently installed conservation equipment in the form of center pivot irrigation, making our irrigation operations 90% more efficient. These methods to conserve large amounts of water are well known to farmers. However, the problem is cost, in capital letters. Our equipment and installation was over $200,000. What is needed is more subsidy programs to help farmers acquire this costly conservation equipment. Thank you for that email, Anthony. And so I would really like to hear what Travis Miller from AgriLife Extension has to say about that.
Yes, I'd say over 80% of our irrigated agriculture in the state right now is center pivot irrigation. Farmers have found that, one, they have lower fuel costs, two, they have more water efficiency, and three, crop yields are much higher, so they've purchased it. Yes, they're expensive. Who's going to bear the cost is beyond my pay grade, but it's certainly important way of conserving water.
Is that still spraying water over the acreage?
Well, there's many different systems on center pivots. There's one system where we just actually drag a sock in the furrow, and the water never. I mean, it comes directly out on the ground. There's
right.
LIPA and LISA systems where there's very low pressure and the emitter is very close to the ground, so there isn't much of a spray. We don't see any systems where they're spraying from actually the main pipe on the pivot like we saw 30, 40 years ago.
Right, because the main complaint was that you'd lose half the water before it even hit the ground, evaporation. What about borrowing more techniques from the Israelis? And they've done a lot of in breakthroughs with drip irrigation, computer-controlled drip irrigation.
Yes, I've traveled to Israel. I've collaborated with Israeli scientists. I'm familiar with what they're doing, and we're doing a lot of the same thing in West Texas. I'm going to say we have 150,000 acres of drip irrigation in West Texas at this time. That's the really expensive stuff. That costs on the order of $1,200 or so an acre to install, but you get nearly 100% water use efficiency.
So we do have this conflict between the rural areas and the urban areas scrambling over water, who has rights to the water, and who's going to make better use of the water. And so how's our agricultural community getting ready for this, and what are they doing?
We have no substitute for the food and fiber system we have. If we don't have it, it's gone. If you think importing oil is a problem, try importing food. So the society has to be ready to say, hey, we're going to have a viable agricultural system, and we're going to figure out ways to collaborate between urban water users and rural water users. Maybe develop some of those more efficient irrigation systems or go in with them on the cost of them. But we can't do without agriculture. And we can't do without urban water use. But a lot of what we do in our department is look at how to make urban water use more efficient, more efficient irrigation systems, more efficient plants and plants in species in the urban landscape to reduce water use.
Right.
We can't do without urban turf grass and plants, or would have heat islands that would be virtually unbearable.
Okay.
But we have to have efficient use of water.
Okay, we're going to continue this conversation about the Texas drought, use of water, and food production. We're going to have the NPR News coming up next. Travis Miller is going to stick around with us. We're going to talk to Gary Navon. He's an agricultural ecologist. Stay with us. The Source continues on KSTX. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're continuing our discussion on drought and food production and climate change. Earlier in the hour, we heard from Farmer DeStefano about conditions on the ground at his farm in Central Texas. Also, we have AgriLife Extension Service Associate Head Dr. Travis Miller on the line. And also, we welcome to the conversation Gary Navon. He's an agricultural ecologist, an ethnobotanist, and a writer. He's a researcher, a social scientist at the Southwest Center at the University of Arizona. His book is Growing Food in Hotter, Drier Land, Lessons from Desert Farmers on Adapting to Climate Uncertainty. And he's looking at how we can change to this hotter, drier climate and still grow enough food for our population. So I want to welcome Gary Navon. Thanks for being on the show.
Great to be with you. Thank you. And I enjoy your other guests as well.
So let me ask you, Mr. Navon, about where do you think, what's happening? I know that your prediction is, or you agree, that we're going to continue to get hotter and that climate change is responsible.
Well, that's right. You've had 81 to 98% of your counties in exceptional drought for the last several years. And NASA's James Hansen believes there's no way to explain that frequency and severity of drought happening in the way it has without linking it to long-term climate change. Regardless of whether you do that, farmers know they're facing climate uncertainty, and the best farmers and ranchers in your state are already adapting to shifting climatic conditions through their practices, and we need to support them in that, whether they call it climate change or not.
Our phone line is open. The number is 614-8980, 614-8980. We really want to hear from folks about how they've noticed the change in their farming practices, gardening practices, just about the weather, and what they think ought to happen about water conservation across the state and how farmers, ranchers, and cities can work together to deal with their supply or limited supply of water. So, Mr. Nabon, what can we do? I mean, there's not enough water to go around. Who should get the water?
I believe that each county should set aside a certain amount of water for food production to ensure its food security of its citizens. It's government-subsidized water, whether we like it or not, and that means that we should make sure that food security, not ethanol production or export agriculture, is a primary concern so that Texans are fed by Texas soil and Texas water.
I don't think counties have that authority. I mean, Texas water laws are pretty antiquated and Byzantine.
What I'm saying is communities can do collective water management to ensure that gray water, runoff water, groundwater, and surface water have an integrated plan rather than being treated as separate resources. Legally, there's constraints on each of them. Together, there's ways of making our food security at the forefront of how we use water in an agricultural state.
So when you say gray water, that's is that we're hearing about some communities in Texas switching to using water from, you know, the from sewage treatment plants and stuff?
Biologically filtered sewage water that has the toxic chemicals removed from it is now used on golf courses throughout the West and in some kinds of tree crops, edible tree crops. We don't want them on lettuce or greens, of course, but there are crops where the use of wastewater in whole or in part is fully integrated into crop production. Israel and Palestine and Egypt have done it for years, as have most other arid countries with climates comparable to Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico.
In regards to water, we don't only have to worry about, you know, the use for cities and the use for farmers, but we also have to be concerned about the outflow of our rivers and streams into the Gulf of Mexico, which is critical for the biological health of our fish population.
I agree. The fisheries are just as important as our farmlands, and I really appreciate you bringing that up. Our food production is not just land-based. It's how we manage our water, and increasing drought and water scarcity because of the growth of cities poses additional challenges for all our resource managers. And yet I think remembering that a key human right is the right to food, and that we need to prioritize wherever it is legally possible that some of that water ends up producing food for our food insecure households. That seems to be an emerging issue throughout the country.
So you are calling for the development of certain strategies that would help us be more, I guess, more stabilized this uncertainty that we have. And one of them is dealing with municipalities and what they do with their compost or organic waste.
That's right. In fact, right now I'm engaged in a project that's being considered by EPA to look at the green waste associated with border food produce brokers, the food that comes across in the winter months from Mexico. 10 to 15% of that is trimmed or spoiled by the time it arrives at places like McAllen. And we're trying to see that as much of that green waste gets back on farmlands as compost to build the water-holding capacity of our field, orchard, and vineyard soils. And so this is a win-win situation for farmers, cities, and waste reduction. And, in fact, it reduces greenhouse gas emissions as well. Whether you believe that's a key factor in climate change or not, it's still a good practice to reduce those so our landfills aren't creating problems, but we're using the materials in them to create solutions.
So are you looking for big government solutions, or are you looking to incentivize small operators to do these things?
I don't think any of this has to be done with more regulatory clout by the government. I'm looking for private-public partnerships between municipal landfills and private enterprises to get green waste out of our landfills and onto our land to increase that water holding capacity. And I think this is going to create jobs in our most poverty-stricken border counties if we do it right.
But even here in San Antonio, as we've talked to, tried to get a compost program going citywide, we ran into a buzzsaw of people complaining about the cost.
Well, now we know that there's collateral costs, collateral damage if we don't do this. So we can postpone investing in solutions, but those costs are going to rise. The social costs are greater than the per family costs. And many cities in the West, in at least five states I know of in the West, have already enacted this. I'm not saying that there aren't bumps to having people begin to separate their green waste from their cans and bottles, but we've learned to do that with cans and bottles and other kinds of trash, and we know that jobs can result from it. So when we can have a private solution to this rather than a regulatory mandate, that people get incentives for doing that, their cost of curbside pickup is reduced.
Gary Nabon, we're going to go to break really quick. We're going to continue the conversation, bring back in Travis Miller from AgriLife Extension, talking about drought water conservation on The Source. We'll be right back. This is The Source on KSTX. We're talking about the coming drought we have now and how we expect it to continue, if not just get worse, and the shortage of water and how we have to figure out who gets it, whether the cities get it or the farmers get it, and how do we make sure that everyone is being responsible with it. We've been talking with Gary Nabon. He's an agricultural ecologist. He's written the book Growing Food in Hotter, Drier Land, Lessons from Desert Farmers on Adapting to Climate Uncertainty. Also with us, Travis Miller, AgriLife Extension. He's the program leader for the Department of Soil and Crop Sciences. So, Dr. Miller, let me ask you, in a op-ed that Mr. Nabon wrote for the New York Times, it's titled Our Coming Food Crisis. Do you think that we have an approaching food crisis, Dr. Miller?
I think that is a priority on a global scale. I don't think in the U.S. currently we're facing that in the short run, but they're projecting another 2.5 billion people over the next 30 or 40 years on a global scale, and that'll require that we produce at least 50% more food to feed that number of people.
So Mr. Nabon, obviously, he's a big thinker. He's talking what's going to happen at the next turn of the century and what the situation looks like as far as water conservation and heat. But are people thinking that in those terms at the AgriLife Extension Service where Texas and farmers and ranchers will be in 2100?
I'd say our headlights run out there about 2050 or so, but probably not that far out as far as planning our scientific efforts. Really, you run into issues. How do you get funds to plan beyond those headlights?
So, Mr. Nabon, as you talk about adapting, what do we need to do to adapt? Are we talking about changing what we plant and when we plant and where we plant?
That's right. This doesn't have to be done by more regulations. We can shift our planting times, our irrigation schedules, increase our irrigation efficiency, and these are all things that farmers in Texas and other states are doing. I would have to mildly disagree with my colleague your Texas ag scientists aren't looking out in the long distance. You had a book done in Texas by Texas Tech folks, 1985, called The Changing Climate of Texas. And on the cover, Jim Norwine and John Giardino and Gerald North and Juan Valdez put, the existing climate of much of Texas is already marginal for agriculture and dense concentrations of people. Texas is vulnerable to climate change. That was 1995, before this issue became politicized. And I think the farmers and the researchers are ahead of our politicians on this, and we have to ask our politicians to support this kind of effort, whether our crop prices, like corn, have jumped only 6% in their prices during drought, while the global ones have jumped 23% over the last couple of years. We're facing some food shortages and some increasing costs that farmers are going to have to pass on to consumers. And we need to encourage innovation, and Texas farmers and ranchers are innovating on their own. They need supported and blessed in what they're already doing.
Bloomberg Corn Traders say this is the most bearish they've seen the market since 2009. This is apparently right now we have a record crop of corn.
Well, I was just in Iowa, and they said it was the latest planting ever. They don't know if it's going to mature. We have high corn prices for a reason separate from drought and farmer skill. It's because of the price of corn has been artificially inflated by ethanol subsidies, period. Ethanol is driving up the prices of corn and driving up the prices of beef. And that gives corn farmers and beef ranchers an extra economic wiggle room to do some innovation and some adaptation now before the markets change for the worse. So I think while we do have a bearish market, and I don't think our yields are going to be great this year. 2 years ago, the Heartland Institute told the Farm Bureau that drought and climate change wasn't going to affect crop yields, and we had over 2,500 counties declared drought disasters, 200 counties in Texas declared drought disaster areas for the third year in a row. This is hurting farmers, and to say it's a bearish market and that farmers haven't been hurt is ridiculous. They asked for $11 billion of crop insurance payments last year. That means farmers have been hurt by this drought.
2012 was the worst drought year on record in the Midwest, and crop insurance did step in and pay for it. This is one of the wettest years they've had in the Midwest. You're exactly right. Whether we can mature the crop or not is an issue. If we have an early freeze, we're going to have a lot of injury to the crop. But it's really one of the best-looking crops we've ever seen. So
I agree with you, it could
go one way or the other, depending on whether we have an early fall. But that's what's driving the price of corn, that bearish market down is this potential huge corn crop, 97 million acres planted this year.
We're also seeing extreme wet conditions in the southeast, and so bad that if our crops are being spoiled.
That's right, and that's why we have to get off of this thing saying that this is all about warming or drought. It's about climate uncertainty. Farmers have dealt with uncertainty for their entire careers. They have incredible capacity to adapt and show intelligence with changing conditions. But again, I want our governors and our congressmen to give them incentives to keep on innovating rather than thinking whether it's a single wet or dry year, whether the markets are good or bad. We can just stop this process of innovation. We need to step it up because the uncertainty is not going to go away. I cannot predict to you whether it's going to be a wet or dry year, the best corn yields or the worst corn yields, but I can say that the amount of uncertainty farmers are facing is greater than ever before in American history.
But farmers, they're not really in a position to gamble. They don't want to bet the farm that one product is going to work over something that's been working for generations.
That's where ag research comes in. We have to have production systems and genetics out there that is more adapted to climate variation, whether it's a wet year or a dry year. We have an excellent chance of making a crop.
And Mr. Navon, you say not genetics, but let's look at our genetic our variation that we have in our seeds that we already have.
We need a greater diversity of crop varieties out in the fields, but there's complete wisdom in what our colleague has just said. The genetics is really going to help us. We need to keep on supporting that research that gives us adapted breeding lines. We need to screen the diversity in our crop collections and make a lot of different varieties available to farmers. There's not one single silver bullet that's going to help this problem. We need a lot of different strategies working in concert. And so I really support the kind of great research that's being done in the Texas universities.
I got a comment on our website. It says, please mention the benefits of organic methods of farming. Stop using high nitrogen chemical fertilizers, which will improve the soil and then require less water. Fact is, chemical fertilizers deplete the organic matter in the soil, thus requiring more frequent watering. Is that true?
No, it's not true. The use of chemical fertilizers actually increases organic matter in soils. It doesn't increase it to the degree as you were using a conventional or a reduced tillage system or organic system, but you have more crop residue, therefore you have more organic matter if you have chemical fertilizers.
Mr. Navon?
I don't think we gain anything from pitting organic versus conventional, small versus large scale. We need adaptation at all levels. We need to support all farmers through our research and extension programs to adapt and innovate. And some are going to settle on organic because they can get a better price margin and they're comfortable with it, others with conventional methods. But good soil management is something they're all going to have to do.
So, Mr. Navon,
I'm all about people using whatever system works for them and how they can sell their crop at the best price for their particular production system. But we can't keep making statements like it's going to deplete organic matter if you use chemical fertilizers. That's just not accurate, and we've got to do research before we make statements.
I agree. The point is that if we get diverse adapted crop strains out there, we continue to bless the innovators and help other farmers adopt best practices, conventional, organic, or higher tech. I don't care, but let's make sure that they're cost efficient and they help farmers' bottom line.
So,
let's look at American corn production. We've increased corn yields nearly 500% over the last 50 years. In other words, the average yield.
And all right, so I want to get one more question. Dr. Miller, in November, Texan voters will be voting on a constitutional amendment which will create more money for a water development board that will have water projects across the state. Is this something that's going to help farmers in Texas?
It will be of help to all Texans to have a more certain water supply. I mean, it's up to Texans to decide whether they want to spend the money on it or not, but there's no question that our population continues to increase and our water supply doesn't, so it's a no-brainer to say that we need more water.
Okay, all right. Dr. Travis Miller, AgriLife Extension, Gary Navon, agricultural ecologist, author of Growing Food in Hotter, Drier Land, thank you so much for joining us on The Source, and thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies.